Next Chapter Podcasts.
Ooh, can you feel that? It's the multiverse opening itself up to you, unlocking its deepest secrets and most sacred wisdom, and offering everything you need to be fulfilled, enlightened, and happy. Which is just a long way of saying we've got more indecent for you right here. Without my guests and I guiding you through the weird, horny, scary, and occasionally sticky corners of the world, where would you be? So before your consciousness comes apart at the seams and you go spiraling off into the astral plane, here's a little more from physicist and author Alexander Boxer. So what would you say to somebody like me? I'm a Pisces, and I feel like a very true Pisces. Like, you know, Pisces, the two fish are going like this, and that represents people that have a lot of internal conflict. They say that we're dreamers, our head's always in the clouds. Somebody once told me that we're obsessed with shoes. That's also true. Is that me, like a self-fulfilling prophecy? Or is there any way of saying, yeah, actually, a lot of Pisces are kind of that way, you know?
So I would think about it in a totally different way. Mm-hmm. I would say, what attributes are you particularly interested in that you consider to be meaningful as a Pisces? Good. Now let's come up with a way of asking a whole lot of people whether that they consider that same trait to be interesting to them. And then let's see if there's a difference when we sort people by their astrological sign. And I would wager to you, but again, I can't just say that I know the answer before doing the test, right? This is the fun thing about doing data science tests, right? You don't want to go in thinking you know the answer. But I'd say, okay, can we see a statistically meaningful difference between your answer as a Pisces with your fellow Pisces and everybody else's answers? And my guess, my null hypothesis would be that there's just no difference. If you say things like, oh, well, I consider myself to be intuitive, or I consider myself to be fluid, or I consider myself to like shoes. Mm-hmm. I suspect that if you were to take a couple hundred or 1,000 people and ask them those same questions, I would see no difference in the spread of answers from one sign to the next. That'd be my guess. We do a little bit of this in the book, where we were looking at an ancient idea that the sign that you're born under influences what profession you are drawn to, or maybe what your natural personality trait would lead you to. And so, of course, ancient astrology in some ways was a little bit more straightforward. If you were a Pisces, you were naturally going to be good at things involving water, especially being a sailor, being involved in the sea in some way. And if you were a Libra, you would be involved in the law, perhaps be a judge. And so we looked at Supreme Court justices of the United States and said, can we say that there's meaningfully one more Libras than any other sign? And the answer is no. You cannot do that. But what was interesting, and one of the things that I think is revealing about the fun ways in which modern data can be so fascinating, is it turns out there are some professions where your astrological sign is strongly correlated with you being in there. And the most famous example is it tends to be in professional sports. So in certain sports, you are much more likely to be at the professional level if you are one sign over another. Okay. Fascinating. So why is this? Well, it turns out that people have studied this for a number of years, and it has to do with youth and feeder leagues oftentimes will have calendar cutoffs. And so the classic example is professional hockey, where the cutoffs are always January 1 for your year of playing junior hockey. And so you can watch it over the age of the children that they progressively weed out the younger children. So the best way to be a hockey player is to be born around January, because that means you are the oldest in your cohort. And so if you're 7, 8, 9 years old, that's a tremendous advantage that you have over your teammate who's born in December, who's the youngest in the cohort. Over many, many years of this, you get to the point where the NHL has a definitely statistically significant disproportion of players who are born in the early part of the calendar as opposed to the late part of the calendar. And you see this in a couple other sports too.
That's fascinating, but that makes sense. But you know, actually, one of my producers told me that the Supreme Court, which you mentioned, it has a lot of Pisces on it, which I thought was interesting, because as a Pisces, like I said, I have a hard time like making clear decisions. I don't want that to be the Supreme Court.
Right. So that was the fun exercise we did in the book, where we said, let's actually chart these all out And you see that Pisces is the most common sign for the Supreme Court justices. And so then the question, and this is a question of statistics, is how common does most common need to be for you to say, hey, that's, there's something there. And so it turns out that this is a question that was pretty much helped establish statistics as a field. People were interested in gambling, of course. And so the question became, how do you know if a die is fair? How many sixes do you have to roll before you start to think that die is loaded?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I have a physical die, I would probably think after the third one, right? Because two would seem like a coincidence, but three seems.
Well, that's right. Or if you had a quarter, right, and you keep flipping it and you get heads, you know, is two weird? Probably not. Is six heads in a row weird? Yeah, it's a little weird. And, you know, you can actually quantify how weird that is.
Is there a risk in this kind of like magical thinking? Is there a risk in reading your horoscope every day and, you know, meditating it and maybe going back to it later in the afternoon and saying, oh, yeah, that it said that was going to happen, or, oh, no, that didn't happen?
So is the question that humans could take a totally harmless, light, fun activity and go totally nutso with it and come up with some psychotic way of doing something horrible with it? Well, of course, the answer is yes, because humans are crazy. But, you know, I think if you approach it in the right spirit of, hey, it's a fun way to be aware that this moment in time is unique. And astrology is actually very good at this, because if you look at the cycles and the patterns of planets and stars, they never repeat. They always have echoes of previous moments. There's always similarities to them. But the number of possible combinations of places even the planets could be, even just looking at the visible planets, is so vast that even to just know what's in the sky is really magical. Most people have no idea what planets are in the sky tonight, unless you're really into amateur astronomy. And there's just something beautiful about the way that some astrologers, again, I think many astrologers just check their horoscope online and, okay, today's good, today's bad. But since, hey, wouldn't it be nice to know what's in our solar system? It's a very meaningful question to ask and to just be reminded that each moment, however similar it may be to a previous moment and a previous cycle and a previous time, is unique. And this is an opportunity to do something unique.
Is there a way of pinpointing when historically in time we made kind of the leap from astronomy to astrology? Like we stopped just measuring like planetary spatial differences and started assigning meanings to it?
So that was one of the key questions I had in the book. Because if you know anything about ancient astronomy, there was no difference between astronomy and astrology. These were the same people. And the word gets used back and forth. Sometimes it's called astronomy, sometimes it's called astrology. So even just tracking the usage of the word was something I pursued in the book. So, you know, the basic arc of, you know, your 2-cent history of science is people spent a lot of time looking at the planets and stars, primarily for astrological reasons. But at some point, we were able to use this to develop a new physics around the year, you know, in the 1600s with Newton, and that this is sort of the beginning of modern science, and that's the break. And as cartoonish a story as that is, I think it's the story I more or less ascribe to. So again, the reason I was so fascinated with the topic is that I wanted to make the case that astrology wasn't a sideshow in the history of science, that it is, for the most part, the main event. And it's the main event that leads to the key discoveries, namely the Copernican revolution, the notion that, hey, it's not the sun that's going around the earth, it's the earth that's going around the sun. These are all coming out of our study of the stars, and these are all coming out of our study of the planets. And the reason people are studying this with such great intensity is because we're interested in astrology. So this is all part of the story. But then the question, when do the people who consider themselves astronomers split from the people who consider themselves just astrologers? And for me, the key person is Kepler. He's one of the most famous figures in the scientific revolution. He's the one who comes up with the mathematical laws for planetary orbits. And he is very much both an astronomer and an astrologer. There is in the archives, in his handwriting, well over 1,000 horoscopes that he's computing, sometimes for money, but sometimes simply for personal interest. He is interested in studying this from a totally scientific point of view. He's casting horoscope after horoscope after horoscope, trying to find the patterns in the same way that he's able to find mathematical patterns in the planets. And at some point, he writes in one of his later works that there's just nothing there to it. There's nothing there, at least on the personal side. I think even to his death, he held out the idea that the planets and astrology probably still affected the weather, which is an idea that also had its own life cycle. But I thought that his perspective was truly fascinating, one, because it shows that he is able to, he's one of those truly open-minded people, I think, in the history of science, because he's creating new ideas where the data leads him. And he's forced on several occasions to kill some of his old theories that he really loved, that he thought were particularly beautiful. He has to abandon them at some point. He's sad about that, but he knows what he has to do. And he has this wonderful little description, which isn't very well known, because I found it in one of his texts that's, I don't even think has ever been translated into English. And he describes astronomy and astrology as a mother and a daughter. And that astrology is the mother who's given everything to astronomy. But now astronomy is sort of now on her own, and she's becoming arrogant and proud, and she's denying her own mother. And that, I think we're kind of in the same spot today, where science, the story it likes to tell itself, the story maybe people are taught in middle school or high school, is that there was all of these thousands of years where silly people did very silly things, and then we discovered science and we stopped being silly. And I just wanted to counter that narrative by saying, one, these people weren't silly at all. They were doing incredibly fascinating things. These were incredibly brilliant people looking at the stars, trying to understand what it all means and what it means for us. Questions that are absolutely meaningful to us today. And two, we're absolutely doing silly things today also. We are not somehow less silly than we were 1,000, 2,000 years ago. And many of the silliest things we do today, we also do in the name of science. And who knows what people will look back and say about us 1,000 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah, it is so interesting. I love Greek mythology, and I always really enjoy that there's an explanation for why things work on this planet. I don't think there's a Greek god of gravity, but I mean, if you think about gravity, it does feel like a very divine force meant to keep humans far away from the gods, you know? And there's really nothing to prove that it isn't. I mean, we can prove gravity, we can't prove why it exists, really.
Well, and it's something that isn't very well known, but when Newton came up with this theory of gravity, most of the people involved in the sciences at the time considered it to be this very awkward step backwards, where the whole goal at that point was to be able to describe the way things worked by matter in motion. And now Newton had gone back and said, there's this unseen force that somehow acts at a distance. I have no idea how it does. And not only do I have no idea how it does, but it's not my job to tell you how it does. I just know that there's this force that acts all the way across space and is able to influence things. And the people who were vested in the project of trying to get away from magical thinking and science said, wait, but now we're just back where we started. And they're correct. The theory that we consider to be the crowning achievement of the scientific revolution is essentially an occult power. It's a hidden power. Gravity operating across space. How does it work? Not going to tell you. wasn't Newton's job. Just said, hey, it's there. So in some sense, I think as we enter into this more data-heavy future, the point I wanted to make in the book was that this isn't necessarily new. We've actually been here before, where we have a data-heavy field that vastly races ahead of theory, let's say. And it actually, there's tremendous amounts to learn about how we react to this, you know, how it changes our behavior and how we see the world through the lens of data, and that maybe the stories are ones we don't want to tell ourselves, that, hey, it's easy to trick people this way. It's easy to trick ourselves this way. But, you know, there's this incredibly rich history of people trying to understand the world through numbers that would be beneficial for us to to see as a reference point that we're another chapter in the same story.
My last question, I think, will be, do you think anybody, you know, you have atheists, but like you said, there are so many ways to be spiritual, whether it's looking at the stocks or fantasy football. Are there people that are completely devoid of that, that don't have that at all? Or is that a natural human thing?
Oh, there are definitely people who are just your hard-headed, skeptical people. I like to consider myself one of them. You know, I don't, you know, the key is you have to not care what the answer is. And whenever you have a topic where people care what the answer is, it causes, you get crazy behavior. Whether it, you know, let's even say a forecast when it comes to politics, people want somebody to win. So they're always going to be twisting the data to form it in the way that they want, or you want a stock to go up. So you're going to make the arguments. And so that's another thing that I guess I want to touch on, is that it's clear to me that in our modern world, data is the highest form of rhetoric. You win or lose arguments based on data. Okay. But the data is not neutral, at least not always. And that I think, you know, they say the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing you that he doesn't exist. And I think the greatest trick that data scientists ever pulled is convincing you that it's a science, that it's a form of rhetoric, that just as a lawyer can argue both sides of a case, in most cases, a data scientist can cobble together a story out of the data to argue one side or another. And astrology to me seems to be the template for this. You have a certain set of black and white facts. This planet is here, this planet is there. What does it mean? Okay, now this is where it gets interesting. This is where the human mind comes in and crafts a story. And so I see astrology as the original art form of crafting stories out of numbers. And that now we do this all the time, but let's not pretend that it's new.
Follow, rate, and review Indecent with Kiki Anderson wherever you get your podcasts. Follow the show at Indecent Kiki on Instagram. Follow me at It's Kiki Anderson. Email the show at indecentthepod@gmail.com. And come back next week for more Indecent, where NSFW meets LMAO. Mwah.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide. But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.
Ever heard of stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of stoicism with a lowercase s and not stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference, all that is stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.
Next Chapter Podcasts.